From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Joe Shaneman. It's State of Nevada. The entertainment landscape in Las Vegas is well known for its large theaters, arenas, nightclubs. Now, comedy clubs have joined the ranks. More casinos now host comedy clubs or feature stand-up comedy, and Westgate and the Cromwell are about to join that laugh parade. So what's behind this? Why is comedy becoming king? John Katzlamidis of the Review Journal has been keeping close track of this entertainment industry development, as well as others. With State of Nevada producer Mike Privat, he talked recently about comedy, movies at the Sphere, Celine Dion's comeback attempt, and concert ticket prices. Here's that conversation.
John, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I want to talk comedy.
Okay.
We have discussed this here before, but I feel like however far back that was, the comedic offerings in town have just gone up from there, and it's been like that for the past few years. I feel that now it's impossible to count all the places featuring stand-up comics, whether it's clubs or it's theaters, in some cases arenas.
Yes.
Seems like it's cheap to produce. It's hot on streaming. It works in a variety of different venues. But what else do you think accounts for comedy's exploding popularity, especially in Las Vegas?
I think the simplicity of it, you mentioned it there. I think what we saw, especially coming out of the pandemic shutdown, is comedy was easy to stage. We were reminded of, you know, it seems the basic principle of entertainment, but first venues that had ticketed shows on or near the Strip were comedy clubs, L.A. Comedy Club, for example. You know, I go and see Paul Agata, who's a club and a cruise ship veteran, headline L.A. Comedy Club at the Strat with 50 people spread out, and it's him with a mic and a light, and that's it. And it was a good show. You get value, and it can play, as you said, from the club level all the way up. You know, we got Joe Coy, Las Vegas guy, at T-Mobile Arena selling out all the way up the ladder. I think the thing is that the more Las Vegas realizes that something can work, it's derivative. You know, others follow suit. I would say that the current trend probably you could trace to Jerry Seinfeld at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace.
Right.
Big name, big room. He was right there at the beginning, almost around the time that Celine Dion started there. And he's coming up on 100 dates this year at the Coliseum. So when people see that, when bookers see that, and even when ticket buyers see that, they're attracted to it. You have some big names, and you know whether it's a big name from a headliner or a big name from a venue, Laugh Factory. You know there's going to be some high-quality comedy going on there. I think that's where it all starts.
Now, I got to say, my consumption and knowledge of today's comedians largely has to do with the stand-up performance reels that I'm getting through Instagram and my algorithms. I can't tell you how they first got there. I think you said Joe Coy. I've been following him for years, obviously a local connection. I'm wondering if this also is helping the spread of popularity of stand-up comedy, just based on the fact that you don't have to be in front of TV to know who a comedian is
you
anymore.
You called it. I know. We're seeing this right now. I'll use an example, Theo Von. Now, a lot of comics around Las Vegas who are veteran professional comics had not known much or anything about Theo Von. Now, Theo Von is selling out the Resorts World Theater,
right?
A 5,000-seat venue with basically a background of online joke-telling and his YouTube podcast,
right?
Which breaks news now, you know. There is finally a bridge being crossed between those who started their craft on YouTube or on TikTok or anywhere online to a ticket-buying public, and that has been the big chasm for a lot of performers, how to make that work. I know magicians have had mixed results in doing it. Comedians have found a way to connect and actually turn a profit as a live act from their online activity.
I want to bring up one comedy club in particular. Technically, it's two, and it's called Wise Guys. They're currently located at the Arts District and in Town Square. Neither, of course, in a casino.
Right.
Next month, they will open one inside a casino, per your reporting, at the Westgate.
Yes.
That's the former Las Vegas Hilton on Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why, not just because it seems like every property wants their own comedy club, but, you know, when I get these monthly schedules from these comedy clubs, I'm guessing you get them too, Wise Guys easily has the most amount of names that I recognize. Maybe from those reels, maybe from other things. And they've only existed outside the tourist areas up until now. So what is their story? Why are they so successful?
And they're still not on the Strip.
Right.
Even with Westgate, by the way.
Right.
Their heritage is one of, first of all, it's Keith Stubbs who started the company. He's a veteran stand-up himself. They had a track record in Utah before right. Las Vegas, before the Arts District up there in Salt Lake City. And I think it's Ogden, Utah, where they've been operating. So that's the background. Keith is very well known within the industry. He's friends with, among others, Pauly Shore, who helped. He wasn't an investor in the club in the Arts District, but he was definitely a backer. So they open the one club, and they have enough as a business model coming in from the proven clubs in Utah to expand. They do well. And there's nothing else in the Arts District. There's no other comedy in the Arts District.
Right.
They get that traffic, where I was very skeptical they get any, you know, word-of-mouth walk-in traffic, but they have a good database from their original clubs. They open at Town Square.
Right.
That turns into a thing. There's a dedicated audience there. There's no other entertainment of that type. Westgate Cabaret is their next frontier, and they have had comedy in there before. And Keith has seen an opportunity in that room. It's a good room overall. We'll see. It opens next month.
Now, I'm thinking of you sitting in a place like Wise Guys, maybe also you mentioned Laugh Factory earlier. And I'm wondering, as you're watching some of these comics, for whatever reason, you're actually in the clubs to see someone specific or not. Are you sometimes sitting there going, that's a person that needs to come here more? Like, are you sort of your own talent scout and you're like, this is someone I predict or would like to see become a regular in town?
I've had that happen a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, and I hate to name names, but there are many, many middle comics or club comics. I just was on the phone earlier with Butch Bradley. Maybe you would call Butch a ham and egger. He's a super solid comic. He's taking on a schedule that is Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 11:30 p.m. at Jimmy Kimmel's Comedy Club. And if anybody can make that thing work, it's a guy like Butch Bradley. You've got to really win over an audience. But that's the kind of chances we're taking. I've seen Butch, and I said, this guy should have more of an opportunity. I'll tell you who really is an example of what we're talking about, and she has been in here before with me and Joe and Kelly Clinton, is Lou Anell.
Yes.
Watch out for Lou Anell on Sundays and Mondays. Mm-hmm. She sells out. She crushes it. I found her at Kimmel's Club. My gosh, you know, you see somebody like that and she's playing to a room of about 300 people and scoring every time, late night, Sunday, Monday, as I said. And you think that there's a possibility to expand that up through the ranks. But we've seen, you could use Joe Coy as an example. You know, I never saw him in the old days, but, you know, who's somebody who definitely had that potential and has really exploded. Sebastian Maniscalco is one. He came here early in his career and performed, and now he's at Encore Theater, having performed also at the Coliseum. And there's many, many examples.
Now, you recently reported that Dre's Underground Lounge at the Cromwell is starting a comedy program. Now, Victor and Dustin Dre are more well-known for their work in the club scene, of course, years and years of that. So how did this development for that venue come about?
You know, this is something I've been saying for years, too, as someone who goes into nightclubs, and I cover nightclubs from kind of a different prism. I go there maybe to see a Steve Aoki, but I'm also walking through the architecture on my way there, you know, the heart of Omnia, which is kind of a boutique space. And I'm like, you look at these places and you're like, what else can happen here?
Yeah.
Because it's more than just a nightclub opportunity or late night DJ weekend opportunity. The architecture is so available. The sound is there. The lights are there. The sight lines are there. The staffing is prepared. And Dustin Dre especially, and I've had this conversation over the years, Victor's son, who now runs Dre's, and he decided that Dre's After Hours, which is downstairs,
right.
And people remember this when it opened in 97. Mm-hmm. It was a restaurant that turned into a nightclub,
right.
Dual purpose. And he was looking at that space itself, and I've been down there recently, and you look at it, and you're like, this would be a very cool something else other than, you know, a club that shuts down at 4 a.m. on the weekends. So they partnered with a comedy booker, and they're going to go in there for 6 weeks. You know, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, I think it is, at 7 and 10 p.m. and run club comedy in there and see if it can take hold. And I know that other comedy clubs and other nightclubs are really looking at what happens there, because if you could run, especially if you were to get a headliner, And I think there's a possibility of Jurassic getting a headlining comic to be the name of that.
Yeah.
You would really be onto something. I think comedians would find that across the country would find that a great destination. There's a great deal of potential with this.
Right. And I understand what you're saying when you go into the clubs and look at the architecture. We just have shockingly few intimate spaces just even for music where you could get an act that maybe would only draw a couple hundred people or 300 people. And you're thinking, God, well, the infrastructure's there. It just hasn't been assigned to music. And why couldn't it be for comedy also?
Oh, absolutely. You're preaching to the anointed on this. I remember going through Hakkasan when it opened. And I'm like, you know, this is a great club opportunity here for an emerging Las Vegas band to kind of test drive, you know, if you're going to have it anyway. And I'm seeing that a lot. It's a shame in a lot of ways not to maximize these venues for what they are. You can do a lot more with the big clubs. And I think Dre's, which is, if there is such a thing as a mom and pop nightclub company, it's that one.
Yeah,
that type of thing. They're going to go for it.
So all of this said, I have noticed recently that a few of the comedy shows at the clubs or even the headliner performances, I've seen them being discounted on Groupon. You could see some of the headliners also showing up when, you know, AEG and Live Nation, they have these like summer sales where it's 2-for-1 or every ticket's $25 for a certain amount of shows. And it made me wonder, well, all this growth of these comedy clubs and opportunities to see comedians in the various venues in town, do you think we are nearing a saturation point?
Well, this is an example of Las Vegas. I would compare it a lot to maybe Magic, the Magic culture, in some ways Cirque du Soleil, where you find the breaking point where the tide breaks.
Yeah.
Not through market testing, but in fact booking in real time under real conditions. We might be getting close to that point, but I can tell you, you know, I'm hearing, for example, that the Palazzo Theater might be absorbing some comedy headliners too going forward. Now, we've had the Mirage shut down its Aces of Comedy, a whole lineup, a big one of comedy headliners there. They've been dispersed around town. They might be looking at something at that. I'm not saying it is for sure going to happen, but I've heard that there's that opportunity there. That tells me that the people who book these rooms and who are selling tickets think that there's still money to be made in this kind of place. Another good indicator, let's look at it this way, is Laugh Factory, a famous brand. Laugh Factory shut down at the Tropicana. They're very cautiously trying to reopen that club and to maximize the brand value. This has taken a lot longer than I anticipated. I thought Laugh Factory is going to be a slam dunk. You know, somebody who has an open space like a Westgate would take it on and have it be, this is a ready-made turnkey. Harry Basil runs it. He's got a deep bench of comics. A lot of them are performing around town as it is. You know, Murray Sawchuk, the magician that they've had at the Laugh Factory venues, has been a free agent since they closed the Trop. But it's been slow to develop. And I'm thinking maybe that there's some caution out there about the comedy at the club level. But, you know, Jim Gaffigan, Nate Bergazzi, Sebastian Maniscalco, all coming into Encore Theater. I said Theo Von, Kevin Hart, a big, big headliner, really sells out the theater at Resorts World. So it's hard to say how it's going to happen, how we find it, and if any city can figure it out, it's Las Vegas.
Right.
We'll get to that point and it'll happen naturally where we'll say, okay, no more.
This wouldn't be an entertainment segment without talking about the Sphere. There has been some developments over there. Two new movies may complement the successful Darren Aronofsky picture, Postcards from Earth. That's the film that's playing during the day and occasionally in the evening when there's no musical talent. And this is, as you reported, the big moneymaker for that venue. There is one confirmed film out of the two. This is a concert film essentially about the first Sphere residency, U2's residency, very meta type of occasion here. And then we've got another that you have reported on but said is not yet confirmed. This would be an 80-minute edit of The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And we joked, I remember when we first talked about the Sphere, that you can't just play any old movie at the Sphere, but it looks like there is a way to configure a movie to be able to play the technical specifics of that venue. I think at this point, they probably could just air Lost reruns and still make a lot of money over there. As you see it, where do these new offerings fall in the Sphere's, I'm guessing, evolving plans for non-concert programming. Do you think this was always the case, or is this something they're discovering as they're going
along? I think it's interesting. I think that the Sphere has learned about what it can do and how it can make money on the fly. And I think U2 is a very good example of that. They decided they booked U2 for their 40 dates, and near the end of that run, they started hauling theatrical equipment in there, and even Bono on their last night said, you know, indicated that this was going to live on in the Sphere as a theatrical experience. And from what I've heard about the U2 concert experience film, call it what you will, is that you really feel, if you've seen the U2 show live, you really believe that your brain tells you that you are there again. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that when I saw U2 on their opener especially, I was thinking, I could enjoy this without the band physically present. And I think that on that night and watching them come out and watching them respond at the same thing we were all responding to, I think that they got that feeling too, because Bono kept raising his arms as if to, you know, gather the attention back to the stage.
Right.
Really. And I'm like, wow. So they have something there. The technical quality, the production value of something like that is again, a groundbreaker, I think. Wizard of Oz, the thing about the Wizard of Oz, it's taken a long time to formally announce this, because the Warner Brothers, which owns the licensing for Wizard of Oz, has had to approve what's going to be shown there.
Sure.
But it's taken a while for them to be okay with taking Technicolor technology from late 1939,
right,
and transferring it to this rounded experience. Like, it's going to be 80 minutes. I heard it's $1 million a minute, so you do the math. That's how much it's going to cost. But
wow.
Once it's up and running and those production costs are achieved, it's like the Aronofsky. It just runs, and then you have revenue coming in based on the sales of tickets for it. And Postcard has really hit that model. So I'm thinking that Wizard of Oz, as late as right now, I've heard, is a done deal. They just have not announced it now. And not too long ago, I was hearing it's not a done deal until they really approve everything. You know, some purists aren't going to like the editing down, but a lot of new fans to this technology are going to find it really cool. And I think as like everything else that's happened inside the Sphere, it's going to be a hit artistically. I really do.
And while we're talking about Sphere, you know I'm going to ask it. What are you hearing in terms of new potential headliners for live shows? We don't have any new ones officially announced for 2025 yet. It's too early. The Eagles haven't gone in there yet, but what do you hear that's being whispered so far?
Well, James Dolan in his earnings call said that he wanted a female artist to come in the middle of the Eagles run. Now, we know who it will not be. It won't be the obvious calls. It wouldn't be a Taylor Swift, who's just coming off tour. I think that the opportunity with Beyonce for that timeline has completely passed. She wanted to take the Sphere down for 2 weeks to rehearse. So that didn't work. Dolan said that himself on the 4th of July when they're out there testing the new sound system out there. So look for a woman. I can't hazard a guess. But another name that's come up in 25 is Maña. The Mexican rock band.
Yeah.
That keeps coming up. And I've said this before, what I think the Sphere needs to do with their live entertainment is get off this particular genre of, I will just say, rock bands of a certain age.
Yeah.
They're not exactly alike. Fish, Dead and Company, Eagles, and U2 all have their kind of different vibes. But what do they have in common? They're all legacy acts. And populated by veteran musicians, which is fine when you're there watching, but it would be great for them to bring in something else. You know, I would love to see somebody, you know, this isn't out there, but somebody like an Usher or like a Bruno Mars or like a Lady Gaga, you know, somebody like that to kind of mix up the demo a little bit. Maña is very interesting because they have a very, very fervent following.
Right.
I've learned they wipe out MGM Grand Garden when they play here. And they have the Afterlife EDM show that's coming in over the New Year's Eve run. I think that's 6 shows. It started as a single, and they kept announcing, like every day they were announcing a new show. And that will have great potential, you know, obviously, gigantic nightclub effect. So
yeah, I was going to say, I mean, there's how many DJs would, you know, who have AV people that they already work with, who would jump at the chance to be able to play, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 shows.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. When I saw you too, I was thinking of Tiesto, Steve Aoki, that level of DJ
who
could come in there.
I can see that.
Yes, yes. And I think we'll get to that point. I think we're going to have more variety. I've understood that Irving Azoff, whose client list is includes the Eagles, U2, and everybody who's been in there, has right of refusal until, I think, at the end of the first quarter of 25 for the live acts that go in there. And when that is released, if that's true, and if when that is released, you're going to see a lot of other, you know, you're going to see a lot more variety, a lot more exploration in their live headliners.
Gotcha. So on the topic of future residencies, Janet Jackson is the most recent addition. She's headed to the Theater of Resorts World at the end of December. This is the second residency that she's had in Las Vegas. So she joins country act Carrie Underwood at that venue, which has otherwise been kind of leaning on touring acts of late.
And comedy.
And comedy, correct. And you probably know what I'm going to ask next, given that she was supposed to open that venue with her third residency and the fact that we just saw her at the Olympics performing. Is Resorts World closer to getting Celine Dion back on stage?
Well, there was a great deal of momentum about Celine after her performance at the Olympics, and I was bracing for some sort of an announcement after that, although I had not confirmed anything was coming. There's been a lot of reporting across the landscape about Celine's plans. I can confidently tell you that she will not be headlining a ticketed show in Las Vegas this year. So there was some thought that she'd come in for New Year's Eve. Janet Jackson's booking has taken care of that. And there's going to be more dates for Janet Jackson, by the way, on next that haven't been announced, but we can expect her. They're building this show for a real multiple month run, recurring residency, I should say. Celine, she lives in Las Vegas. She has been working diligently to get back on stage. I do believe something will break next year. How this would happen, is anybody's guess what the show would look like. But she has been working toward that objective the entire way. So I say look for her in 25, look for more Janet Jackson in 25, and Carrie Underwood, who has filled the bill every which way, to her credit, also in 25.
Sphere's going to have a hard time finding female musicians because they're all clearly at Resorts World, right?
Yeah, they're elsewhere. You know, I would love to have seen Adele, you know, re-up and go over there too. There's a lot of potential for that, but that won't happen either. She's off the grid after she finishes in November.
That's right. So I've been dying to ask you about this. Recently, there was an interesting article in the RJ, not penned by yourself, but this was more of a business article, and UNLV professor and vice president of economic development, Bo Bernard, he was talking about the benefit of entertainment and sports to both the Strip and Las Vegas in general. And he basically said that locals, they don't tend to see the bigger picture when they grumble about things like high ticket prices.
Mm-hmm.
And that they should be grateful that such offerings bring more visitors into Vegas and they create more tax revenue for the state and they ultimately provide more jobs. Now, few locals are going to grumble about what tourists have to spend here, but those entertainment offerings are also ours. So we get the same price hikes that they're getting. And given all your experience, you're not just talking to musicians, you talk to locals. You hobnob with people when you're out and about and watching performers do their thing. Do you think that locals would accept Bo's statement? Is there a limit to the, let's call it, gouging that locals would tolerate?
It's a tough issue because I agree with that sentiment that, you know, when you have major acts come through Las Vegas at a high ticket price, you're attracting an audience that is going to sustain our economy. But when you're a fan, you don't look at it through that prism. You brought up Def Leppard, a good example. They've done a residency here. I just saw recently, this couple weeks ago, Steve Miller Band, Journey and Def Leppard at Chase Field in Phoenix. And I went there, I did this because I wanted to see what seeing that type of show at that level was like. All of them I've seen in Las Vegas.
Sure.
All of them, multiple times. And I can tell you that the experience in Las Vegas remains high, top-notch, gold standard, having experienced that show. We don't get every one of them. And having said that, what upsets ticket buyers more than anything, and I'm talking about whether they live in Las Vegas or they're tourists, is going into a portal. Look at the ticket prices for something like The Killers. And you go in there and it says, you know, $250 a ticket. And then you go to checkout and it says $375.
Yeah.
That is a constant complaint for me when they tack on fees. And I've been talking to the people at Live Nation and even people who work at in the Ticketmaster company. Why can't we just have that be the price? And then people can budget it, they can plan for it, and they don't have to be worried about the being hit. And they're going with more all-inclusive. The fees are baked in. They're baked in. So that's a start. I don't have an answer to tell you that it will only be that the market will have to, the demand for tickets will have to subside to the point where the prices will come down. I've seen there are examples of the market softening in lower level shows, or maybe second tier headliners. You know, we saw the Black Keys try to do an arena tour, right, and did not happen. But I do think that there's still very strong demand for the top level headliners.
Sure.
And that is important because they drive this thing. The Bruno Mars, Gaga, when she had Jazz and Piano, Adele, Killers recently, they're up in that level now too, at least in Las Vegas for 10 shows. And as long as you see that demand is there for those acts, you're going to see those prices stuck there. And your argument is going to be, this is the free enterprise system at work. I would love to see the venue operators, the venue owners, and the ticket sellers, the bookers, everybody cut a break to locals from time to time. That would help. We sometimes disassociate from tourists, but in a lot of ways, tourists are our people. They're coming to see us. You know, they're family, friends, they're people who we know coming in.
Yeah.
And we are, in fact, agents and ambassadors for what's happening in Las Vegas, whether it's somebody we know coming in on a convention or it's a family member visiting from Boise. And, you know, they want to do things, and it's like, okay, well, I got news for you. There's a restriction on what we can and can't do. I know that's not the answer that people are looking for, mm-hmm. but I can only tell you that you just have to keep your eye out. And living here, there's a lot of ways to spend your time and be fulfilled than having to save up and go to one Adele show. There's a lot of talent out there. You look at my Cool Hang Alert and you'll find examples. We just talked about the comedy clubs. They're relatively, comparatively affordable. Mm. And you can have a great time in Las Vegas without having to break the bank or go into debt.
John, thanks as always.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And that's Review Journal entertainment columnist John Katzlamitis with State of Nevada producer Mike Pravat.